It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The 2015-2016 session of the U.S. Supreme Court begins today. Will this session result in landmark decisions such as last year's rulings on the Affordable Care Act and same-sex marriage? It's hard to tell, but joining us with a look at the issues on the docket, which include affirmative action in college admissions and voting rights, is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Always good to be with you, Paul. Happy to be here.
Happy new Supreme Court term to you, sir. Last year, in so many ways, was a year filled with landmark decisions. I don't know if it's possible to duplicate that. What do you think, on the heels of such a landmark year, we'll see this year?
Well, we're not going to top the gay marriage decision, that is for sure. But there are some very significant cases on the horizon. As you were saying, affirmative action is back, and we're going to talk about the power of unions, yet another different kind of voting rights case. The term really is packed with cases that will make a difference in people's lives, even if they don't have the sort of marquee value of gay marriage or Obamacare.
The Fisher versus University of Texas Austin case is the one that deals with affirmative action.
That's right.
And tell us about this case.
Sure. This is actually the second trip up for this case. It involves the University of Texas at Austin, and there's a student named Abigail Fisher who did not get into the University of Texas at Austin. The University of Texas has a unique system that it designed for college admissions after the University of Michigan affirmative action cases of some time ago, about 10, 15 years, in which the Supreme Court said it's okay to use race as one factor among others in college admission, but it can't be the deciding factor. So different universities took different paths. In Texas, at that university, there's something called the 10% plan. And every high school graduate in Texas is eligible to go to University of Texas at Austin, which is their flagship university. If you're in the top 10% of your high school graduating class, no matter what kind of high school, where it sits, you know, what kind of standards, the top 10% are automatically eligible to attend University of Texas at Austin. And this has been a successful program for the university as far as they're concerned. It has made their student body actually more diverse than it was under the previous kinds of plans. And it doesn't select people by race or by ethnicity. Abigail Fisher, in the current case, is challenging that. She did not make the top 10% in her high school class. She was close, but she didn't make it. And then she tried to get in based on her merits otherwise, and she was denied admission. And her argument is, you should have let me in. I had better credentials than some of the members of minority groups who got in under the 10% plan. The Supreme Court looked at this a couple of years ago and said to the appeals court, you've used the wrong standard. You should look at this more strictly, and sent it back to the appeals court. The appeals court had found, no, that this complies with the law. And now it's back, and the Supreme Court has to now decide whether or not that Texas 10% plan violates the Equal Protection Clause. So we could have a great change in how affirmative action is viewed.
But this is not necessarily a case that's going up against the principle of affirmative action or the concept of affirmative action. It is merely taking issue with how affirmative action is applied.
I'd say that's right. And it deals only with one particular part of the affirmative action debate. This isn't about contracting. It isn't about public employees. It is about college admission only. Now, having said that, the standards that the court applies, the ways that it interprets the law, can be important and have an impact in all kinds of areas involving affirmative action. So what the court is doing is it's saying, we judge all racial categorizing by the highest standard, that is strict scrutiny, and we're going to decide whether the Texas system, which does not by its concepts and by it, the things that it takes account of, it does not depend on race, can that actually be considered a racial violation under the Constitution? So it takes the discussion we've been having about this issue for so many years to an entirely new level.
Another case is Evanwell versus Abbott. and it concerns one person, one vote. Explain what's going on here.
Well, this is the next significant voting rights case we've had. We had the Voting Rights Act itself kind of eviscerated just a few years ago by the Supreme Court. Here, the concept of one person, one vote was something that I imagine every American grew up with. I mean, to me, it was so second nature, I couldn't imagine how it could even be challenged. But here it is. For the longest time, the idea of one person, one vote has been that every congressional district has to represent about the same number of people. That means that every person within every district has roughly the same representation within Congress. And this has been the rule for many, many years. What's challenged here is in Texas, here we go with Texas again, there's an argument down there that when you count the population for purposes of one person, one vote and drawing the districts, it should not be the whole population, the census population. It should be just the voting age population, the voting population. This will change the way that congressional districts can be drawn. It will shift power if the court goes for this plan and says it's got to be the voting population. What will happen is you'll shift power to more rural areas and away from cities, away from places with large immigrant and large families, large immigrant populations. It will shift power away from those places. They'll have less congressional power, and you will have more congressional power in the hands of more rural areas, areas with smaller families and so forth.
And in the case of Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, the issue of union dues as forced speech has come up. What does that mean exactly?
Well, this is another thing that will affect working people. In this country, some workplaces, of course, are unionized. And when a union has a membership, it collects dues. Those dues are sometimes, as we know, used for covering the union's expenses and might sometimes be used for political speech. We know that unions have been big donors, especially to Democratic candidates over the years. Now, years ago, back in the 70s, union dues as a concept were challenged by some people. You can't force me to pay union dues, the argument was, because some of that goes for political activity, and I don't want to pay for that political activity.
And so the idea that you're endorsing some political idea or candidate or party is considered forced speech?
Yes. And so the outcome in the 1970s was a decision in which the court said you can be forced to pay union dues to the extent that it is fair to cover collective bargaining costs. Right? This was called the fair share idea. So having a collective bargaining arrangement benefits everybody in the workplace, whether you belong to the union or not. It wouldn't be fair for people who don't belong to get all the benefits and not pay for it. So the solution to the problem was you don't have to pay the amount that might go for political speech, but you certainly have to pay the amount that would support collective bargaining because collective bargaining helps everyone in the workplace. What's at issue in this case is a number of members of a teachers union in California. They're contending that because they're part of a public employee union, even supporting collective bargaining by public employees, that is a form of political speech. You know that there's been a lot of argument in the last few years, especially Scott Walker has been involved in this as the governor of Wisconsin, that public employees should or should not be able to have unions. And the contention here is that even collective bargaining fair share money, that that's a form of political speech too, and we should not be forced to pay for any of that. If the court goes for that argument, if it decides in favor of the plaintiffs, that will have a very significant impact on the ability of unions, frankly, to even exist.
Right. And does this sort of strike you as something similar to the challenges to Obamacare, that this is a conservative effort to try to wipe out the unions?
Well, I think there is a similarity. In the last term, we had a number of cases go up to the Supreme Court, which were really put there by conservative legal organizations, conservative lawyers, and accepted for argument by the conservative wing of the court. The thing is, they didn't win many of them last year. This year, the same thing is happening. This one-person, one-vote case pushed up by conservative legal organizations. This teacher union case pushed up by these conservative political organizations. And in any one of these, if the right wing of the court attracts a fifth vote, these could be very significant victories in terms of the right wing legal agenda. It's out there. They want to work toward it, and they have those cases on the docket for the Supreme Court.
And speaking of Obamacare, did you say there was another challenge to Obamacare?
Not on the court's docket thus far. I think we might be done with that at this point. There have been now two Supreme Court cases in which Obamacare was upheld. It's hard for me to imagine that they would take another one. But the Obamacare case last term was of this same type. It was a kind of very, my characterization, far-fetched argument that would have destroyed the whole system. It was pushed onto the court's docket by people with a number of right-leaning organizations who wanted at all costs to get rid of Obamacare. The conservatives on the court accepted it, and they simply didn't have the votes to carry out what they wanted.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest, Pitt Law Professor David Harris. We're looking ahead to the 2015-2016 session of the Supreme Court, which begins today. We've gone over some of the big cases that are already on the docket, but there could be more. So what should we be watching for in terms of some other cases that the court may accept and be willing to hear in this term?
Well, I think the thing to watch first and foremost are abortion cases. There are significant new laws in Texas and in some other areas of this, primarily the South, that require much more of doctors. They require them to have hospital privileges, all kinds of requirements for clinics. These cases are working their way toward the Supreme Court, and I would not be surprised to see the court take one of the Texas cases on the requirements for doctors. The court has not had an abortion case for argument in front of it in quite a number of years. And it will be a case that attracts a lot of attention because, A, it's an election year, of course, by the time we get started with the term, and, B, we have this ongoing controversy with the Planned Parenthood videos. So the political branches are very fired up about the abortion issue one way or the other, depending on what side you're on. And to have the Supreme Court take one of those cases would be, I think, everybody would be watching it, and we would see exactly what happens as time goes forward.
It seems as though, I mean, abortion is a constitutional right in this country. And is this a matter of those who are opposed to abortion trying to whittle away at the ability of people to have them? I mean, there are some states where you're lucky if you can find a clinic to go to. So if they can't wipe it off the books, are the opposition forces looking for ways to make it so difficult that they might be able to reduce, if not eliminate, abortions that way?
Yes, that's exactly what's happening here, and it's been happening for many years. The folks who want to get rid of abortion altogether have not had enough votes in state legislatures, and that couldn't overcome the Supreme Court's ruling in Roe versus Wade anyway. So state by state, idea by idea, they've been constricting access to clinics, to doctors, to the abortions that people want to have by everything from requiring, as they did here in Pennsylvania, requiring that clinics take on a lot of the characteristics of outpatient surgery centers. This greatly restricted the number of clinics that are available to people, by requiring doctors to have hospital admitting privileges, by saying you can have you can't have an abortion after 20 weeks. All of these things are ways to chip away and chip away and chip away to the point where it's, for all practical purposes, abortion will not be available to the great majority of people.
Anything else that's on your radar as far as something that we could see in 2015-2016?
Well, I think some technology-based cases may make their way up to the Supreme Court. we have new technologies such as cell site simulators. These things are known as stingrays. These are a technology that you can put, it's the size of a suitcase, you could put it in a police car. And what it does is it sends out a signal that convinces all the cell phones in the area, hey, I'm a cell tower. And that brings those signals in, and it's as if there is a giant vacuum for all of the cell information, internet information, all kinds of things. The police collect that, and they can, in certain instances, use that maybe to track down criminals, and not just people who've stolen cell phones, but all kinds of other activity. This is now bubbling through the courts, and a number of states have kind of stepped up and said, wait a minute, you need a warrant for that. The FBI was the agency that was passing these devices around to local law enforcement and making them sign pledges never to discuss the technology. I mean, that's a sort of a first. I've never seen anything like that. So eventually, I think that technology will work its way up to the court. Maybe not this term, but perhaps the one after.
What would be the legal justification for that? How can you say that it's okay to, you know, plop down, what you said, this briefcase that pulls in everybody's cell information? Presumably nobody, you know, the people whose information is being collected, they're not aware of it.
No, they are.
What does this remind me of?
Yes, yes. It looks a little bit like the NSA program,
right,
doesn't it? And so the legal justification would be more or less the same thing, that this information through your cell phone, through your internet connection, this has all been passed on to third parties, your internet service providers, the advertisers, whoever. And when you give something to third parties, it no longer can be private. And therefore, there is no expectation of privacy. Therefore, the government doesn't need probable cause or a warrant. Now, this is from some long-standing law that goes back to the 70s. It has never
been. Would not have anticipated what is in existence now.
Absolutely not. But when Snowden blew the cover on the NSA metadata operation, those were the cases from the 70s that the government trotted out to justify the vacuuming up of the metadata from all calls in the United States. And this will use the same justification. What we're seeing now is that courts and even some state legislatures are saying, no sale, we're not going there. You got to have a warrant at least to do this.
Very, very interesting stuff. David Harris, Pitt Law Professor, looking ahead to the 2015-2016 session of the U.S. Supreme Court, which begins today, and we'll stay on top of this and other legal issues as they develop. As always, David, great thanks.
You're welcome, Paul. Good to be with you.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA.